All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome back to Curious Tales of the Talmud. Folks, I hope you are ready for a wild ride, because tonight we have another fantastic, absolutely fantastic exploration of the Talmud and the Talmudic story. So last week, just to kind of get back into the swing of things, last week what we did was we took our first jump into the sea of Talmudic stories. And we focused on tales that were bizarre, outlandish, just totally wild stories. And what we did was we established a very important, what I'm going to call a critical principle. And that is that the stories of the Talmud are like every other part of the Talmud. This is important. The stories of the Talmud, like every other part of the Talmud, are absolutely instructive. Just like the halacha, the legal aspect of the Talmud is certainly instructive. You got to know what the law is, so the Talmud tells you what the law is. The same thing is true with what we call the Agada, which are the stories of the Talmud. They are also eminently instructive. Whereas the bulk of the Talmud tells us about the laws and the legality of this and what happens if this, that, or the other, etc., the stories of the Talmud are teaching us moral instruction, the morals, the ethics, the values of Judaism, as well as a little bit of Jewish mysticism, a little bit of the soul of Judaism. Because of the nature of these teachings, i.e. they're less surface, they're a little bit deeper, that's why we explained at the end of last week, at the end of the first lesson, that's why we explained why these stories are embedded inside of these curious tales, kind of encoded in a cryptic fashion. So, as a way of introduction, kind of to get us back into the flow of things, I want to ask you a few questions, and we'll just schmooze it out. If you have the answer, just go for it. All right. So, the first question I'm going to ask is as follows: what was the? I want to go through the three tales that we spoke about last week. What was the deeper message of the tale that we read? That had the seafarers who were talking about using a club to ward off the wave that has white fire at its crest. What was? Give me like the 20-second version of that. Who's got it?
It's warning off temptation, strength from the Bible, strength from the Torah.
Good, good. And what was the white? What was the white symbolism? The white was, remember, the white was the purity and the innocence, i.e., what do we tell ourselves? How do we get into trouble? Because we tell ourselves, what do we tell ourselves? Justification, not so bad, I deserve it, whatever. And so you need the club, and what would you say the club was? The Torah, and that kind of, and the teachings of Torah reminds us that not to despair, not to feel lonely, etc. We can ward those off. Alright, the next tale, the second tale we covered last week was the tale of the fishy island. The island that was really a fish. What was the message of that one? Who's got it? Anybody?
Don't build your house on the sand.
That's it. Right. You gotta be careful. Be careful. You never know what actually is what's under there. You never know if there's a fault line, so to speak. In other words, all too often in our history, we got very comfortable in our host country, in our host nation. We said this is on one level, this is talking from a historical perspective. And next thing we knew, there was some turmoil and upheaval in that host country. So the idea is we got to keep the boat nearby, we got to keep our values nearby, and also an escape, you know, vessel. But we have to be careful. We have to always remember where our true connection lies and our true eternality lies, and that is with Torah, with God, etc. Third tale was the giant wilderness corpses, the dead of the wilderness. What was the message there?
That we have to live life. We can't just live spiritually.
Good, good. The dead of the wilderness were those spiritual escapists, those professional spiritualists who wish to leave the world and just kind of meditate in the desert. And we said that if you embrace that lifestyle, there's a cessation of movement. Movement happens when you're engaged in the world and making the world a better place from the ground up, as opposed to kind of going off in some desert nomadic life. Rather, engaging the world is what God wants from us, and that's how we truly become movers and shakers. Now, today what we're going to cover is another type, another subgenre of Talmudic tales. And these are tales that seem to portray God in human terms. The title of tonight's class, Lesson 2 of Curious Tales of the Talmud, is When God Prayed, a Study in the Art of Anthropomorphism. I have a funny story about that, which I'm going to tell soon. All right, good stuff. No, this is the high priest, but you're going to see why that's relevant soon. Okay, what we're going to see, what we're going to cover tonight are tales from the Talmud that seem to portray God in very human terms. In other words, stories that, like, where you read about God almost like a human being. And as we'll soon see, these tales are confounding at best, and at worst, they're borderline heretical. It seems like heresy. And yet, of course, there's so much depth and meaning packed into these stories, messages that have a profound impact not only in how we view God and how we view our relationship with Him, but also can these messages from these tales can have a profound impact on how we relate to other human beings. So it's not only relevant in our relationship to God, but also our personal relationship with God, but also in our relationship on a personal level with other human beings. The truths that we learn tonight are going to impact every part of our lives. So let's begin. All right, as we mentioned last week, ever since the Talmud's been around and studied, it's been a lightning rod for controversy. Those who have sought to kind of incite hatred, you know, any type of animosity toward Jews, have only had to flip a few pages before they found something to say, aha, look what it says in the Talmud. I can't believe it. Look what the Jews have in their Talmud. It's terrible. We got to burn the Talmud, etc. But while last week what we pointed out were those stories, those outlandish stories that seem to portray the Talmud and the Talmudic sages as maybe silly, as legend tellers, as kind of people that make up make-believe stories, this week the issue is more substantial and much more devious. And there have been those, and what I'm saying is like this, there have been those throughout history who have looked into the Talmud, studied the stories, and accused Jews of heresy. Straight up. Why? It's due to the, as I mentioned before, the anthropomorphic descriptions and stories about God that are sprinkled throughout the Talmud. We find these stories that speak about God in very human terms. And it only takes someone who's not so keen on the Jewish people to say, look, it says in the Talmud that God is like a human being. God has emotions. God has a form. God has, etc. All of the anthropomorphic, all of the human type descriptions that the Talmud gives, which we're going to study. Say it again. Anthropomorphic means ascribing, here, it's right over here, a statement, story, belief, etc. that ascribes human form or attributes to a being or thing not human, especially to God. In other words, when you refer to God, or as seeing, as king, God sees, God's eyes, God's heart, God's emotions, etc. All of these phrases seem to ascribe human attributes toward a divine entity, a divine being. Yeah.
Christianity talks about God in human form.
I'm with you. Listen, I understand where you're coming from. What I'm saying is, though, that this has definitely been something. In fact, we're going to read about it right here in text number one, where you had individuals who over the years, and we're not only in the recent past, but many, many, many years ago, 1,000 years ago, that were using these stories as saying that not only is the Talmud not true and made up and above a mice and whatever, but the sages are totally off base with regard to their view on God. They said that Jews are not only engaging in heresy, but also, what's the phrase that I'm looking for? I have it in my notes. Physitheism. You know what that is? Again, ascribing like a physiological, like ascribing a bodily, you know, type of form to God. And anthropotheism as well. Like, again, anthropomorphic terminology in reference to God. All right. So take a look at text one. One famous attacker against the Talmud and against the sages was the 12th century Spanish apostate Jew whose name was Peter Alfonsi. Again, he lived in Spain in the 12th century, in the 1100s, and his original name was, you get ready for this, Peter Alfonsi. Peter Alfonsi, he wrote against the Talmud. But what was his real name? You ready? Moshe Sfardi. That was his name, right? Real Jewish name, Moshe Sfardi, who enjoyed a good shawarma, and maybe some lafa and falafel. Anyway, this is probably before that. But anyway, the point is that he changed his name to Peter Alfonsi, and he writes a work called Dialogi, or Dialogi, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, that rips into the Talmud. What we're going to do is we're going to read a work, a modern work that kind of analyzes Alfonsi's critique of the Talmud. Take a look at page 48, text number 1. Ezra, please take it away. Page 48, text number 1.
Okay. The first longish illustration of Alfonsi's 12 chapters indicts Jewish theology for its crude anthropomorphisms, primarily with explicit reference to Talmud prominence, Haggadot, that violate both reason and any defensible interpretation of the Old Testament. Peter cites the rabbinic dicta that God wears thin lacquer, that he rages and grieves over the present dispersion of the Jews, that he is located in the West. All of these belief that no sane mind could entertain.
Right, again, you have all these things in the Talmud. God wears tefillin. Oh, really? What, God has an arm? He's wrapping tefillin around his arm? He grieves over the exile. He's located, Shechina b'mayrav, the divine presence in the West. God is directional like that? What does that mean? All right, continue.
The Agadah's extensive attribution of human characteristics to God upset Alfonsi most. He condemns such homilies and their rabbinic authors for demeaning the divine majesty and perfection and for deviating from the teachings of reason and scripture. Peter has no dearth of disparaging terms with which he characterizes such rabbinic error in the Dialogi: bad, evil, insane, indecent, ridiculous, worthy of derision, stupid, foolish, lewd, and the list goes on. Beyond this, beyond his intense dislike for this rabbinic lore, however, some recent investigators for Alfonsi and his writings have detected an indictment of the Jews for heresy. According to one recent monograph, Alfonsi wishes to show that these texts contain doctrine heretical by the standards of classical Judaism, making Judaism, as it was practiced by Alfonsi's contemporaries, a heretical deviation from the law.
So he said straight up that the way the God is portrayed in the Talmud, and the way his contemporaries, again in the 12th century, were studying Talmudic, the way they would study and revere the Talmudic teachings, heresy, it's heretical, it's a deviation from Judaism, it's not what the Torah means, etc. It's humanizing God. And he didn't like it. So he critiques with all of the terminology that we just read. Now, here's the troubling thing. You ready for the troubling thing? He's right. 100% right. The Talmud does it. Wherever you...
What was his background?
Who, Alfonsi? The Fonz. Alfonsi. Who? Alfonsi was... No, I mean, yeah. He was an apostate Jew. Yeah, I mean, he was Moshe Sfardi. He was born Moshe Sfardi. What was his background? I don't know how much he learned. Look, you don't have to learn much Talmud to come up with troubling things. Either outlandish stories or stories that seem to portray God as a human being. Okay, so we're going to get a little bit later in a few minutes into an understanding of what exactly is going on here. I mean, we have to explain what's going on. What is it? So what does it mean when it uses these human terminology? I'm with you that we're gonna present this idea that we don't literally mean it, but it seems like he was taking it literally, and there were others as well that were taking it literally.
Well, it seems that then those people weren't very well educated.
I'm with you. I mean, it depends.
My little bit of knowledge.
Okay, good. All right. So this is maybe something that an idea that's more prevalent nowadays, but it seems like back in the day this was not something that was necessarily widespread known. Now, I'm sure it was known by those who were authentically studying Talmud, but certainly this was, let's call it, fodder for his claims and his axe to grind, if you will, against the sages of his time and the sage of the Talmud and the Talmudic teachings. But again, the idea here is that he is right, because the Talmud does describe in many places, God in human terms portrays God as having these human characteristics, character traits, even some form of a body. And the question is really, what is going on here? So on this note, I want to tell you a story of a little girl who was at home, sitting by the table, and she was drawing a picture. Little girl. And so her mom comes over and says, what are you drawing? So she says, I'm drawing a picture of God. So the mother says, but no one knows what he looks like. And so the little girl says, yeah, that's because I'm not finished yet. So obviously, how good, huh?
I heard it that she says, now they do.
Now, well, soon they will, or along these lines, right? It's a similar. So again, the issue that we're going to grapple with is, what are these anthropomorphic or humanizing stories of the Talmud really about? To kind of jump into this discussion in a very real way, what we're going to do is we're going to read now a story from the Talmud. Story from the Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin, which, by the way, Sanhedrin is known as... Do you know who the Sanhedrin were? Who were the Sanhedrin? The High Court, right? The High Court in Jerusalem. Tractate Sanhedrin deals with some of the most complex legal matters. And in that tractate, no tractate is immune to these stories and tales. In Tractate Sanhedrin, the tractate that deals with all these laws of the High Court, etc., we find the following story in text number 2. Again, a story that seems to portray God in human terms. The story occurs with, I just want to give you a little bit of historical background. The story takes place with a rabbi whose name was Rav Avohu. Rav Avohu. I think that's how, yeah, Avohu. You might see his name also as Abahu, but again, it's the same name. He lived in the 3rd century in the land of Israel. He lived in the 3rd century in Israel, and he is famous not only for being an expert in halacha and the law, but he was also well known. He was renowned as an expert agadist. He had a firm grasp on the agadic teachings of the Talmud, the stories, the lore, the ethical, the moral teachings of the Talmud. He had a very firm grasp on that. And in fact, the Talmud relays, there's a few stories where he would often debate heretics. He would debate those that were trying to kind of portray Judaism in a negative light. And he would debate them and went back and forth to the point that it says that his physician, whose name was Yaakov the Heretic, I guess he was a good doctor, but his name was Yaakov the Heretic, tried to poison Rav Avohu because Rav Avohu was battling the heretics in his debates and was successful. So his own physician tried to poison him, and two colleagues, Rav Ami and Rav Asi, they kind of found out the plot before it was too late, and they saved him. Dramatic story that's told in the Talmud, but we're not going to get into that story. What we do want to get into is again a totally outlandish story with regards to God. This is on page 50. Text 2, Jan, please take it away.
A man heretic said to Rav Avohu, your God is a priest, inasmuch as it is written, let the Israelites take for me, Mechur Huma, the priest in time. Now, when he buried Moses, where did he immerse himself afterwards to rid himself of ritual impurity? He cannot reply that he immersed in water, for it is written regarding him. He has measured the waters, the oceans, in the palm of his hand, Isaiah 40:12. He immersed in fire, Rabbi answered, as it is written, behold, God will come in fire. Is immersion in fire a valid method of purification? The heretic asked. On the contrary, Rabbi replied, immersion in fire is the preferred method, as it is written, all that cannot withstand fire,
story makes sense a little bit? Let me fill in some gaps here. Let me fill in some gaps with the story. The heretic comes to Ravo and says, I'm going to point out a flaw that we have with God. Here we, I have an issue. And you really need to do some explaining on behalf of Judaism and Torah and Talmud and whatever. What's the issue? Well, it says like this. God says at the beginning of the Torah portion called Truma, Hashem says to tell to Moshe, Moses, to tell the Jewish people, V'yichu li Truma, take for me Truma. What does the word Truma mean? Truma means an offering, a donation. It can also mean a tithe. Truma was what was given to the Kohanim, to the priests. It's known that the priests would serve in the temple. They didn't have a day job. That was their day job. So they weren't earning money. But they, so how would they live? How would they eat? So people would give a tithe. They would give a certain percentage of their crops. People were farmers. So they gave to the temple, to the Kohanim, to the priests. And that's how they ate. So God says, take for me Truma. Take for me a tithe. So the heretic says, that proves that God is a Kohen. God is a priest. Step number two. The Torah tells us, at the end of the Torah, the end of the five books of Moses, about the death, the passing of Moses. And the Torah tells us that Moses went up on Mount Nebo, Har Nebo, and no one was with him, and no one saw him, and that's where he was buried. And the sages asked the question, simple question, if no one was with him, who buried him? And the answer that's given is that who buried Moses? Who do you think? God, Hashem. God buried Moses. Asks the heretic as follows. Who's referred to as a min. M-I-N. Min. The heretics ask the following question. Look, God is a Kohen. God is a priest. And then he buries Moses, so he comes in contact with death. What happens when a priest comes in contact with death? What is a... So he's ritually impure. So he needs to be ritually purified. How are you ritually purified? Part of the process is by immersing in a mikveh, in a ritual pool of water. So how can God immerse in a pool of water? If the verse in Isaiah says that all the water in the world can fit in God's palm of his hand. So how is he going to immerse into a mikveh? It's not big enough. Where is he going to find this ritual pool of water? Understand the question? Again, step one is God is a priest. Step two is God buried Moses. Step three, God must have become impure. So how did he become pure? Right? This is the logic of the heretic. Upon which Rav Avoh answers, oh, he didn't immerse in a mikvah of water. He immersed in a pool of fire. Fire. So the heretic asks, is fire a valid method of purification? Rav Avoh says, absolutely. In fact, it's better than water. It's only that some things you can't put it, like a human being, you know, you can't run through waters, so you can't run through fire or immerse in fire. So we need water, but really fire is the ideal method of purification. That's the end of the story. Are we cool with this? Does it make any sense? Okay, why doesn't it make sense? What are some of the issues that we have here? I have like a whole list. I probably have like a dozen issues with this story. Anybody want to share, like, what's nonsensical about the story? Burton, what do you have?
Well, you're making the assumption that God has you conform.
Correct. Good. Where do we make that assumption? Which point along the way?
You've got more than one, but the first one is that you're saying God is a priest.
And, that sounds like a human characteristic.
Well, it would be a human characteristic.
All right, good. What else?
And God buried Moses. How did God bury him? How does God bury anything?
Right. I'm with you. Okay, good.
Anything that they're ascribing to an action is only an action that can be committed by a human being. So you could, you know, extrapolate from that God is a human being. But nobody has ever seen God. So how can anybody make the statement that they know what he looks like?
He's super elusive like that. All right, Chana, good questions. Chana, what do you have?
Why does Avahu even answer?
That's a very important question. It seems like Rav Avohu is actually entertaining this conversation. Like, he doesn't cut him off and say, whoa, God's not a priest, oh, you're wrong. When God said, V'yichuli truma, give to me a truma, he actually wasn't talking about tithing. He was saying, when you build a tabernacle, I need a donation. We need gold, silver, and copper. Nothing to do with the Kohen, nothing to do with the priest, nothing to do with those laws. Totally different scenario. He doesn't cut him off and say, you pulled something out of context, and in fact, you need to go back to study the Torah with a teacher because you're clearly misunderstanding this. He doesn't say that to him. He says, yeah, you're right, he is a Kohen, and yeah, he did bury Moses, and he did become impure, and oh, if your question is about water, okay, it was fire. Come on.
What's the difference in that and God slaying the Egyptian?
Good.
Firstborn of his own hand.
So how would that happen? Good. All of these questions we're going to answer. But again, the question is like this. The real question is in Rav Avoh, because if Rav Avoh is understanding it, as we'll get to soon, in a non-literal way, so why is he entertained? Well, what's going on here? It seems like he's saying, yeah, God's a Kohen. God became impure. How did he become impure? Contact. What God's touching the dead body? What he has fingers to touch? I mean, that's another element of the question. So the whole story begs to be understood on a much deeper level. This is what Mark, what you got?
Why is the question about the red calf? Is that just about water?
Say it again.
Why is it the question about the red calf and not just about water?
Oh, about the paraduma, I'm with you. I also had that question, I'm not sure. In other words, because what Mark is alluding to is the fact that part of the purification, being coming in contact with death, is that you have to have sprinkled the ashes of the red heifer, and then you dip in the mikvah, and the question is, well, where's the red heifer? But I guess the heretic felt like a red heifer you can find, and you can sprinkle, because you could just sprinkle a little bit, but God, to immerse completely in a mikvah, in a pool of water, there's no pool big enough. To which Rav Avoh answers, oh, you don't need water, you could use fire. And I guess they had a big bonfire somewhere. This is the end of the story. Again, it's a story that involves a heretic already, but the whole story says, kind of demands us to understand it, to delve deeper.
Defined by space. So, if chooses,
right.
And it could be as large as the world.
I'm with you.
No limits, no parameters,
not even in the unlimited. All right, I'm with you. The question, though, is again, what is Rav Avoh? What's the dialogue all about? All right, so here's where I want to go with this. And by the way, you can understand why, like, reading a story like this, Pierre Alfonsi is thinking to himself, like, this is a Talmud? Really? They're debating over whether God immersed in water or in fire. That's what we're getting into. The heretic says water. And the rabbi says fire. And the heretic's like, okay, you win, fire. Okay. Because God's a priest and he became impure because he... So Alfonsi says... I don't know any of this. I'm with you also. I told you I have about a dozen questions. Why is fire better than water? Fire is bigger than water. Who says fire is bigger than water? Maybe water can also fire can also fit in God's hand. Oh, but there's a verse in Isaiah that says that God comes in fire. So I guess that means the fire is big enough. Where is that fire? Is God really of human form? Yeah, but God fits on a mountain. The whole story makes no sense. Here's the deal. I'm with you. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take a massive step back and present a major idea. And that is, and you might have been thinking, I think the point was mentioned, it was alluded to, and you might have been thinking this, if you didn't specifically mention it yourself, but you might have been thinking this in the back of your head, that the anthropomorphic terminology, in other words, the fact that God is sometimes referred to in human terms, does not begin in the Talmud. So, Peter Alfonsi, with all due respect, you don't have a beef with the Talmud. Guess what? You have a beef with the Torah. Because the Torah said that God spoke. The Torah says that God is compassionate. The Torah said that God stretched out His mighty hand. B'yad chazaka, His mighty hand, His mighty arm. And saved the Israelites. The Torah uses, not the Talmud. The Talmud is not the first Jewish source that comes up with this anthropomorphism. Now, it's not the first source that comes up with this ascribing human qualities to the divine. It begins in Torah. Let's come up with some more. What are you familiar with? What other human characteristics have you heard ascribed to God in the Torah? What comes to mind?
Gender.
There's something, I mean, that basic, like
describing sex. Right, exactly.
Emotions, anger,
right? God got angry and he wanted to destroy the world with the flood, etc. What else? What other human descriptions come to mind?
Compassion,
right? Hashem, Karachem, V'chanun, Erech HaPaim. God is slow to anger and compassionate. Very, very human terminology.
He likes to negotiate.
Likes to negotiate back and forth. How many righteous people do we save, Sodom? All right, what else? He's jealous, right? So I have here in my notes, the Torah refers to God as merciful and just, vengeful and angry. It tells us about his speech. He spoke and it was. Said that let there be light, there was light. Mighty hand, which I mentioned, his watchful eyes. It says in Deuteronomy that God's eyes are upon the land of Israel. Einei Hashem Elokecha Bamei Reish Hashem Achar Shana. His eyes are upon the land from... His eyes are upon the land. It says also in the books of Scripture that he has white garments. Really? Really? Doesn't have a more colorful attire, wardrobe. I mean, white garments, what does that mean? All right.
Can't part of this be understood that man is incapable of freely conceptualizing, so they have to describe it in terms that we understand.
Exactly, that's what we're going to get to. Maimonides will give us beautiful language to understand this. By the way, the reason that we know we can't take this stuff literally is because although we find this terminology in Torah and in the Talmud, again, it doesn't begin in the Talmud, it begins in the Torah, in the five books. The reason why we know that we can't take it literally is because Judaism has always known. And it's actually one of the 13 principles of faith. Number 3. I'll put it right here on the PowerPoint. Take a look at this. Maimonides writes, again, this is the third principle of the 13 principles of faith. It cracked the top 10 even. Cracked the top 5. The Creator is neither a body nor any bodily attribute, nor is he subject to bodily phenomena. He's not human. He doesn't have a body. He doesn't have a form. He doesn't have human emotions. He doesn't have any bodily phenomena. He can't be affected like a human being. Nothing in common with a body with human form. That is what Maimonides writes. And it's... Yeah? So what's the answer? Good. Good. No, it's a very good question. The answer Maimonides gives us. In other words, now this provides the tension. Maimonides says, there's no body, there's no form, there's no comparison, there's nothing human about it, about God at all, right? About God at all. But then you have the Talmud and the Torah itself. He, arm, eyes, ears, emotions, love, compassion. What's going on? Maimonides, in his Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the laws of the fundamentals of the Torah, gives us beautiful, beautiful, as they call them, the Lashon Hazav, like a golden language, a beautiful, pure, like every word is polished, where he explains exactly what is going on. This is the classic Jewish take on it. Text number 3, Chana, please take it away. We're on page 52.
If so, what is the meaning of expressions employed with its below his feet? The tablets will bring with God's fingers, God's hands, God's eyes, God's ears, and the like. All these expressions were used to relate to human perception, which knows only corporeal imagery, for the Torah speaks in the language of man. They are only borrowed descriptive terms. This is apparent from the verse, when I sharpen the blade of my sword. Does God have a sword? Does he need a sword to kill? Rather, this is a metamorphic imagery. All such expressions are similarly metamorphic images.
So what we have here is basically what Maimonides writes is, we have here classic metaphor where the Torah is using terminology that is not meant, as we've said before, as was mentioned, it's not meant to be understood literally. Don't think for a second that God actually has ears and has eyes. It's language that we use. So why do we use it? The reason why we use this language, if it's not accurate, so why do we use the language? And what's the answer? We've been saying the answer. The answer is because we have no other language to use. Go use a language that we don't have. We only have certain language. If you want to talk about God communicating, you're going to use the phraseology God spoke. It doesn't actually mean communicating. It means relaying something or revealing something, bringing something into the open, just like speech reveals to you what my inner thoughts were, right? Before I opened up my mouth, you didn't know what I was thinking. Now that I speak, you know what I'm thinking. So too, creation also allows that which is God's desire to unfold and come into being. So we use the language of speech, but it's not really speech. God doesn't brandish a sword, but it's terminology that human being can relate to. This is found, this is a very important text right here, Chovot HaLevavot, famous classical works of Jewish thought and philosophy. Take a look at page, I don't know if the English is on 53 or 54, but take a look at text 3b. Sandy, please take it away.
We are compelled to portray the Creator in material terms and to use the familiar attributes of created beings in order to approximate an idea that will establish the reality of the Creator's being to the human mind. The books of the prophets presented God in the physical terms that are accessible to human intellect and understanding. Were we to speak of him in a manner strictly appropriate, using only spiritual terms and ideas, we would have understood neither the words nor the ideas, and it is impossible to serve what one does not know.
Good luck having a relationship with God or to understand. If you use language that you cannot relate to, so it remains you have no idea what we're talking. It's totally out there. All right, continue.
Therefore, there was a need for words and concepts that match the listener's power of comprehension in order that the matter should affect their hearts. This was done through using, at first, physicality, the medium of physical terms. Afterwards, as the students grow in wisdom and can be more precise, they are informed and brought to understand that all this was metaphorical, a use of literary trope. The true nature of the subject is more refined, exalted, and transcendent than we are able to understand. The devoted mind will strive to remove the outer husks of the words and their materiality from the subject and elevate it from one level to the next until one arrives at the true nature of the subject being investigated to the extent that the human mind is capable.
So here's the point. Of course God is not human, and indeed nothing of the physical universe that we know and love. But good luck talking about God if you don't use terminology that we can relate to.
I disagree with you. We're made in the image of God.
Okay.
So, of course, he speaks, he walks, he has hands, eyes.
Okay, so again, we have the classic Jewish understanding that God does not possess a human form, and that all of the terminology that we're using of God walking and God moving and God's hands and God's this and God's that, it's only a metaphor to understand. I mean, this is Maimonides. This is not. I understand that you're feeling strongly about this, but this is not. It's not at all. Something that's a new idea. This is Maimonides. This is a classic Judaism. This is what's been taught for thousands of years. That these phrases are not a literal description. I'll give you an example. You'd say, this child is so sweet. Are you referring to the sugar content? Right? You say, oh wow, that's so sweet of you. You're not literally referring to something that's sweet and therefore has a lot of sugar. You're referring to a conceptually sweet. But yet there's a connection between the two. There's a connection between the two. Just like sweet is something that's desirable, that's good, that creates a certain type of pleasure, so too when a child does something sweet, the charming, precocious, whatever, there's a certain sweetness involved. In other words, there's a certain comparison. But as Maimonides writes, and as Rabbeinu Bachya writes as well, that it's incumbent upon the student to strip away the physical or the... Say it again?
The
husk, right. To strip away the literal meaning of these words, to understand it in a more figurative sense. Which means as follows. That God doesn't need eyes to see. God's sight is not limited to eyes. In fact, God doesn't see the way we see. The way we see. God knows. God doesn't know the way we know. God doesn't see the way... What does it mean that God sees, or that God has eyes, or that God is looking at the land of Israel, etc.? It means that there's a certain divine providence, a certain strong connection. Of course, God sees everywhere, if you will, sees everywhere. God's providence is everywhere, but there's a special connection with the land of Israel that's nowhere else. How do we relate that concept? So we use terminology as God's eyes are upon the land. How do we use terminology that evokes the fact that God broke Egypt and rescued the Jewish people? So we say a mighty arm. Just like a human being, if he would be victorious over another in battle, it would be employing arm. arms and swords or whatever, so too we use these this terminology in reference to God. But it's never, God forbid, to be understood literally, that God literally... What does it mean, by the way, that we're created in the divine image? So that's also explained. What does it mean we're created in the divine image? Just like God certainly has intelligence, the human being has intelligence, as opposed to other forms of creation that don't have the same type of creative intelligence. Or an interpretation that I prefer is that we're created in God's image. God doesn't have an image. Exactly. We should never box ourselves into a certain image and say, this is the way I am, I can never grow. Just like God is beyond image, we don't have to be stuck in the status quo, no matter what we've done. It's again, a different interpretations. But the concept is that we're not understanding God. And all of the anthropomorphic terminology and descriptions of the emotions, of the physical traits, literally, God forbid, we're stripping them of the literal connotation, understanding it on a deeper level. By the way, something that we may have raised in prior classes in passing, but something that Maimonides writes elsewhere that's important to know, every time, because this is all about the physical characteristics, what about the emotions? God got angry, so he decided, he was upset at what was going on by the times of the flood, so he brought the flood to wipe out mankind. He regretted what he had... He got upset? He has, like, emotions like that? So the way it's explained in Maimonides is that every time you find in the Torah a description of God's emotions, you should know that God doesn't have the emotion. But, so what does it mean? It's the emotion that a human being would have accompanying a certain action. In other words, just like if a human being was taking that action, it would be filled with that emotion. So we say that God had that emotion, even though he's just doing the action without the emotion. And even doing the action, what does that mean? Is not actually doing the action with hands, etc. But that's the concept. Even the emotions are not an actual emotional experience, but these are phrases. These are terms that are, again, it's due to the limitation of human language, limitation of our minds, but it's a way for us at least to have some sort of relation with the divine, some way, some measure of understanding it. But as we mature in our understanding, we're able to strip it of the concrete and get a little bit more abstract to have a deeper sense of what's really going on. So this is the classic Jewish take on the human terminology that Torah employs, that the Talmud employs. It's spiritually figurative, not literal. Now, based on all of this, this is very important. We can now go back to the dialogue between the heretic and Rabbi Avohu that was recorded in Tractate Sanhedrin, which we read. Remember the one about God being a priest and immersing in water, but he can't, so then it's fire. And we ask the question, what is going on here? Is he really a priest? Of course not. What's this immersion that he became impure because he buried Moses, and so he touched Moses with his hand, so he became impure? What's going on here? And how come Rabbi Avohu doesn't cut him off? According to the Marsha, who is a classic Talmudic commentator, who also is one of his major contributions to the Talmudic commentary, is that he explains a lot of these stories. He has a very simple explanation, which, by the way, we're not going to be satisfied with, and we're going to actually give a much deeper explanation at the end of the class. So in 45 minutes, you're going to get a much deeper explanation. But I'm going to give you his explanation. He says, Rav Avohu was not interested in debating with the heretic. So he said, you know what? You're right. In other words, this debate between Rav Avohu and the heretic was actually a debate about whether you can describe God in anthropomorphic terms in the first place. The heretic says, God has human features. Rav Avohu says, are you kidding me? Of course he doesn't have this. You can't take this stuff literally. But instead of telling him that he's completely wrong, because, like, what's the point? What's the use? He can't say, you're right, because then the guy thinks now he stumped the rabbi. So he's stuck. Right? You can't to start undoing his way of thinking, oh, you can't understand God in human terms. He's a heretic. That's what a min is. It's referred to, by the way, as a min. This is a min, a heretic min. There are three Talmudic labels for heretics. There's min, there is apikores, and there's kofer. Three different terms that all are loosely translated as heretic. Min, apikores, and kofer. The three names for heretics are referring to three different types of heretics, of three different types of heresy. A min is someone who has a misguided belief about God. An apikores is someone who has a misguided belief about God's relation to creation, relationship with creation. And a kofer is someone who denies God outright. The kofer is... one who has faulty beliefs regarding the Torah. So again, the min is someone who has mistaken beliefs about God. The apikoros is someone who has mistaken beliefs about God's relationship with the world and creation. And the kofir is someone who has misguided beliefs about Torah itself. So the point is that the Talmud refers to this fellow as the min, as a min, a heretic, as a min. Why min? Because again, he thought of God in human terms. He read the Torah, and he took the Torah literally. It says, God asked for truma, for the tithe, he's a Kohen. He buried Moses, now he's ritually impure. Now he needs water. So Ravo says, oh yeah, yay. Gewalt! What do we do with this guy? It's going to take way too many years to re-educate him, to huh? So he says, you know what? Oh, you're right. The Zakoin is impure. If the issue is water, fire, fine. We found the verse. All right. Everything's fine. Fantastic. See you later. He was kind of brushing him off. This is what we find. Are we satisfied with this explanation? Not necessarily. Marnie, please read text number 4. This is the explanation of the Marsha. Take it away. Text 4, page 55.
The question of the heretic indicated that he believed God to be a corporal entity. For a spiritual entity is not susceptible to ritual impurity. Rav Avahu's response was tailored to the heretic's clear understanding of God, and was only intended to dismiss his question.
He was just trying to get rid of him. He really didn't want to get into the whole back and forth. Oh, the whole premise of your question is wrong because God's not a human being. Oh, start getting into that debate. Fine, Kohen, impure, you have an issue with the purity? Fire, not water. Done. He just wanted to get rid of him. Take a look. Take a look at... I love this verse. This comes from... I have the source here in my notes. This comes from... Proverbs 26:5. Are you guys ready already? Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. What does that mean? It's exactly what happened here. The guy was a fool. Come on. He thought God was a human being, basically. So he said, answer a fool according to his folly. You know what? Answer him according to his own misguidance. Why? Because if you let it go, if you don't answer him, he's going to be wise. He's going to think that he got you. He's like, I got a vow. He didn't have an answer. How can he dip in the water? He's too big. I don't know. Got you. So you say, you know what? I'll give you an answer. That way you're not...
What is that?
I have no idea.
He's cutting the ground.
I'm not sure why. He's cutting it with scissors. Oh, that's what it is. It's a little less... It's probably not the wisest way to cut grass. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I don't know. Which came first?
Torah, 5 books, yeah. We gave the introduction last week, yeah. So Torah is about 1,500 to 1,800 years prior to the Talmud. The Talmud is a collection of the oral law and the oral tradition that, and a lot of the discussion and the back and forths that accompanied the fleshing out of the law. But the Torah is the 5 books. I mean, that's the original document, more than 3,300 years old. The point is, though, that throughout Jewish literature, just to kind of summarize, because all of this is really step one, and then we're going to advance it to a much deeper level right now. But let's just kind of summarize. So we have here, we've established that throughout both biblical and Talmudic literature, you will find anthropomorphic terminology. It's never meant to be understood literally. It's always figuratively. And as we learn more and study more and our minds become able to understand things more abstractly, we're able to peel back the layers and understand God on a more abstract level, to say that God is not angry, but what that means for God, etc., whatever that means, or God doesn't have the emotions or the physical features, and the issue that that the heretic had with Rav Avoh is obviously nonsensical from Rav Avoh's perspective. He was just trying to get rid of him, so that's why he gave him that off-the-cuff answer. He wasn't actually conceding the point, he was just getting rid of him. And of course, Pierre Alfonsi's issue with the Talmud, that the fact that the Talmud has these anthropomorphic tales, it's not an issue, because again, you're reading it literally. You read it literally, then you have an issue with it. Who told you to read it literally? It's metaphor, it's figurative language. Jonathan, you have a question? Well, look, the guy said about water. He's like, well, how does God go in water? So he says, you know what? Fine. He didn't go in water. He went in fire. And if you're asking, is that a kosher immersion? Yeah, because there's another verse that you can twist that means fire. All pulling verses out of context. It's not about actually koshering a vessel. It says when you kosher a vessel that becomes non-kosher, so you put it in fire. If it can't go in fire, put it in water. That's why we kosher with hot water. Yeah, water is also creation. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. Of course, that's what I said. You guys, it doesn't, from beginning to end, the story doesn't make sense. The point is, you're right, it doesn't make sense. But the heretic thought that he had a big question, so he said, you don't have a big question, you have a small question. The whole question doesn't begin, but at least in his mind, he was satisfied, and everyone went home happy that day. Here's the point. All of this is 1.0. All of this is very, very basic. Very basic, and some of you may have already heard these ideas or know these ideas. What we're going to do now is peel back much deeper and get into a mystical understanding of anthropomorphic terminology. And what we're going to find is, again, some amazing, amazing, amazing lessons. In order to get ready to launch into the much deeper discussion, let's turn to page 56. And we're going to do a quick exercise together. And if you have an idea of what it means, just feel free to jump in there. We just want to move through this. We just want to get training to kind of decode these anthropomorphisms. So you don't have to read with a partner. We're all doing it together. Learning exercise one on page 56. Try to decode the following biblical anthropomorphisms, i.e., what do these phrases actually mean to the best of our understanding with regards to God. So what does it mean? Oh, we actually did the first one. God created man in his image, so we said that image means intellect, or image means unimage, etc. Okay, fine. God...
I cheated. I looked it up on the net. It said we were given free will.
Oh, good, 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 good. That's another one, right? Just like God can choose, etc., only the human being has free will. Good, that's another one. God spoke to Abraham. So what does that mean that God spoke to him? I guess we kind of covered this before also. What does speaking mean? Where he actually has a voice?
That Abraham understood God.
He somehow knew what God wanted from him, etc. So God revealed himself to Abraham on some level, so therefore we call it speaking. Alright, then we have an Exodus where God says to Moses, you will see my back, but my face shall not be seen. What do you think that means? God has a back and a face. What does it mean that God's back will be seen, but face not?
You'll see the results of my work, but you won't see the source.
Good, good, right. You'll see the back is like... it's kind of after all is said and done, you'll see the result, but going into it, whether it's a situation, knowing why something is happening or knowing how something is happening, just like a face kind of reveals the inner workings and the why and the wherefore, etc., that you cannot see with regards to God. We don't understand the plan, but the back, the end results, the in retrospect.
If you see my face, you'll die.
That's the next phrase, yeah. I mean, no. That's not. It's in the Torah. That's the very next thing. For if you see my face, you shall die. Right. That's a dangerous place to be in. Right. Or it means that if somebody would know the master plan, they couldn't. It would be too overwhelming. Or whatever it would mean. But the bottom line is, this never understood in the literal sense that God has a face and a back, and you're seeing one and not the other. Yeah. So that's right. That's another way of it. It ties along the idea that when we look back at events, we could try to piece together why something happened. But as we're facing the situation going into it, it's hard to decipher why. You know, we ask the question, "Why is this happening to me? Why is it happening in the world, etc." But in retrospect, sometimes we can have perspective on it. It's along the same lines. Like we can understand the results, but not necessarily the why, etc. All right. Next one. When I sharpen the blade of my sword, I guess we kind of had my sword, right? My sword is. We had the before, the idea of what causes harm in the world, etc., or death, destruction. The heavens are my seat. What do you think that means? We didn't talk about this one. This is a good one. The heavens are my seat.
Is it that God is pretty big and...
It's a big seat. Well, Kabbalah actually gives them a deeper way of understanding it. What is the connotation of seat? Place where you reside. So on one level you could say that that's where God resides, but there's a deeper, huh?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so that's right. The abode, being revealed there, but there's actually another way of looking at it that actually almost goes the other way. Just like a seat, you lower yourself down, God is lower down to be in the heavens. In other words, God is even bigger than the heavens. When He's in the heavens, it's only lowering of Himself down. God is even bigger than the heavens. We sometimes think that God is in the heavens. God only lowers Himself down to fit in the heavens. God is even bigger than the heavens. Make sense? All right, fine. Again, but it's not that the heavens are my seat, but that the fact that God is so great, so grand, that not even spiritual heavens can be a true vessel or vehicle for the divine presence. Now, these are some ideas. So we've now flexed our anthropomorphic decoding muscles. Now we're going. Here's really where things heat up. We have two stories. This is it right here. This is where things get real. We have two stories, text 5 and text 6a and 6b. Two stories that will challenge everything we've said about anthropomorphic terminology. Everything that we've said up until now sounds great and makes sense on paper and theoretically is perfect until we hit stories like these two. And then all bets are off. Text 5, Jay, you ready? All right, page 58.
Once do we know that God got that phrase? What says, "I'll bring them to my holy mountain and gladden them in the house of my prayer." Verse that I does not say the house of their prayers, but rather the house of my prayer. And here we derive the God prayer.
Again, we'll understand what we're saying here. The Talmud in Tractate Brachot is saying that God prays. Listen to this. God prays. God prays. Really. Again, Kivesi Vase Tfila, my house. What's that? What's that phrase? Havios Maharkochi, Santa Vase Tfilasi. My the house of my prayer. My prayer means that God prays. That's what the Talmud says. Continue.
What is his prayer? Rabbi Zura Bar Tova said, "In the name of Ra, this is God's prayer. May it be my will that my mercy should override my anger, and that my mercy should prevail over my harsher and adjectives, that I should behave with mercy toward my children, and that my kindness should extend beyond the strict letter of the law."
Continue. Yeah.
It was taught by Rabbi Yishmael Ben Eliezer that the high priest said, "I once entered the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur to offer the incense. There I beheld God seated upon a high and exalted throne, and God said to me, 'Yishmael, my son, bless me.' I replied, 'May it be your will that your mercy should override your anger, and that your mercy should prevail over your harsher and attributes, that you should behave with mercy toward your children, and that your kindness should extend beyond the strict letter of the law.' And God nodded to me with his name."
How do you make sense of this one? God prays. God has a house of His prayer. What is His prayer? That my will should... Sorry, that my mercy should override my anger. Who's He praying to? Himself? May it be my will. What does that even mean? If you want it, so make it happen. May it be my will. What does that mean? And then it gets even crazier. Even less sensical. Rabbi Yishmael, the high priest, goes into the Holy of Holies and he sees God on the throne. What that means, we don't even know. I guess he has a divine encounter. And God says, "Yishmael, my son, bless me." God needs a blessing from a human being. And then he blesses God. "May your anger, may your mercy override your anger," etc. And God nods with his head. "Yeah, amen, I like that blessing." What's going on here? What's going on here? If we try to decode this story, it's very, very hard to strip away the literal here and take it to a figurative level. Even understanding what we explained before, that none of this is meant to be taken literally, but even figuratively, what does it mean? Because if you take the concept of prayer figuratively, what is prayer? Prayer means that you're asking somebody else for something that you can't have on your own or that you can't accomplish on your own. Prayer means that you stand, you ask. It's a request. You're beseeching. You're communicating with another outside of yourself. Another that you don't have, because you need something and you can't get it yourself, so you need to ask someone else for it. What possibly could we say that God doesn't have that he has to ask someone else for? And it seems like he's praying to himself. May it be my will. God has to pray to himself? Sounds schizophrenic. Like, what's going on over here? And then he asks a human being for a blessing against something, it sounds like against something that he doesn't have himself, that he needs the human being to give him. What is going on here? And then he acknowledges it, nods with his head. The story is extremely puzzling, even if we try to strip it from the literal meaning and understand it in the context of metaphor. How do you metaphorically understand God praying? Or God nodding with his head? Or God asking a human being for a blessing? Metaphorically, it doesn't make sense. Seemingly. Text 6a and 6b. Here we have the second story, completely different story. A story that seems like straight up fairy tale, legend, fable. The story begins the fourth day of creation. The Torah tells us that on the fourth day of creation, the luminaries were created. And we're going to read now the verses. Charna, take it away, text 6a on page 60 from Genesis chapter 1, verse 16, about what happened on the fourth day of creation. Who notices a contradiction in the verse itself? There's one verse.
Great and then a great and small.
You notice that? The Torah begins by telling us that God made the two great, that God made how many great luminaries? Two. Both of them were great. And then after the comma it says, oh, or after the colon there it says, oh, wait a second. There was only one great and one was small. So which one was it? Were there two great luminaries or only one great and one small? Make up your mind.
The Talmud.
Yes, yes. I'll read it in the Hebrew so you can hear it. Vayas Elokim, and God made as Shnei Hamaorot Hagdolim, the two luminaries Hagdolim that were Gadolim. They were large. Et Hamar Hagadol Lememshelat Hayom, the large Maor, the large luminary, the Gadol luminary to rule the day. Ve'et Hamar Hakaton, and the small luminary Lememshelat Halayla to rule during the night. And again, it starts off that they're both large, they're both gadol, they're both great, large, big, and then a second later in the same verse, one is large, one is gadol, and one is katan.
Maybe they're both great, and one is big, and one is small.
All right, so I guess you could say, generally speaking, they're both kind of large relative to each other. In other words, so some answer simply like this, that in reference to earth, they're both large. In reference to each other, one is larger than the other. So like, it doesn't have to be a major contradiction. But yet our sages were ever sensitive to these nuances. And the fact that the Torah first calls them big and then switches big and small, the Talmud has a story that goes along with
it. That's how we perceive. Because during the day, the sun seems very large. We really don't look at it because it is so incredibly bright. But when we see the moon, it also seems very large. We know it's smaller. But at night, it seems
because it rules the night. But it says that the small luminary rules the night. So it should have said the big one ruling the day, because the big one looks bigger the day, and the other big one at night, because that's the big man on campus. At night is the moon.
What I'm saying is, the small luminary appears large at night. That's my point.
I'm saying, so if it says, if it's referring to the mar that's ruling, the luminary that's ruling the night, it should also be called large, because in the context of, I understand what you're saying. I'm saying you could still, anyway, here's the point. The Talmud in Tractate Chulin gives a story. This is one for the ages. Trust me, this is one for the ages. Trying to continue because you got a short one. 6b, page 60. Here's the story. This is wild stuff.
The moon said to God, "Sovereign of the universe, is it possible for two kings to wear one crown?" God answered, "You have a valid point. Go and make yourself smaller."
You love that, huh? Originally, the Talmud says they were both large. Comes along the moon and says, what? This sky is not big enough for the both of us. Right? Old Western style. So God says, you're right. Can't have two rulers in the sky. You know what? It was your suggestion. You go smaller. Continue. You hear what's happening here? God admits, it seems like he admits that he's wrong, but he can't go back. So he says, I'm sorry, and the Jewish people should bring an atonement on my behalf? What? Continue.
This is the meaning of what Rabbi Shimon ben Kish said. Why is the goat offered on Rosh Hashanah?
Rosh Chodesh.
Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, different from all other periodic goat offerings. Why is only this goat considered a sin offering from God? Because God said, this goat shall be an atonement for my having made the moon small.
Gaval. Two large loaves. So again, according to the Talmud would have us believe that originally the moon was as large, and I guess in this sense, as luminescent, as bright as the sun, upon which the moon can, I guess, would there be a night even? I don't know, because if it's so bright, then maybe it's always day, but there's two different sources of light. I don't even know what that means. And then the moon complains, so the moon is made smaller, and the moon says, because I brought up a valid point, because I'm right, so you punish me. God's like, I guess you're right, I'm sorry, but the good news is, there's going to be atonement on my behalf, and there's a goat on Rosh Chodesh, which is a goat of atonement for the sin of God, for making the moon smaller. Really? Does this make any sense? Try to strip it, and we don't have time to like work through it and engage. Try to strip this story down, or peel away the layers, and after the anthropomorphic layers, and peel away the metaphor, peel away, and get more. Bottom line is what we're saying is that God says, "Bring an atonement, offer atonement on my behalf." How do you understand that? You tell me that, you know, when you talk about God's love and God's kindness and God's hand, that it's not literal but it's figurative because God has all of these amazing things. Well, God's wrong also. God makes a mistake. Originally, he made a mistake, it seems like, because he made them both big. And then he's like, one should be small. But then he regretted making them small. He said, no, you're right. Maybe it shouldn't have been made small. So then I need the atonement every month. You have to bring a... What's going on here? It's very, very perplexing, very difficult to understand. What we're going to explain is now how this story of the Talmud contains some of the most deep Kabbalistic teachings. Again, what we're going to explain right now is how this story in the Talmud contains some of the deepest teachings of Jewish mysticism about God, about the universe, about the role of mankind, about the creation process itself, about the relationship that we have with God. And as I mentioned at the top of the class, this will give us profound lessons as to how we can enhance our human relationships. So let's start. We're going to start, we have two tales that still need to be understood. The first one is about, what was the first one? We just had it. God praying, and God asked for blessings. The second one is about the moon, the story of the moon and the sun, and making the moon smaller, and then needing atonement for that. We're going to start with the second story first, the one that we just ended with. Kabbalah tells us as follows. Before the beginning. You know, Bereshit, the Torah begins with in the beginning. Which, by the way, some have said is the first reference to baseball in the Torah. Where's the first in the big inning? Burton, you look pained. Was it that bad? All right. Okay. All right. So in the beginning, you have the Torah's account of creation, how the world came about. But before the beginning. This is like pre-Genesis. Pre-beginning. Kabbalah teaches there was only one reality. There was only God. It's not like there was creation. There was nothing else. Was before creation, there was nothing else there. It was only God. Purely God. God's light, if you will. But God, again, light is not literal. It's about God's presence filling everywhere. There was nothing else. There was only God. For whatever reason, we can never really climb into God's mind, which He doesn't have a mind, but God's rationale, if you will. But for whatever reason, God decided to create. We know this because we're here. God decides to create. He decides to create a universe. And everything that's involved with the universe he decides to create. Kabbalah teaches that at the beginning of this creation, at the very, very beginning of the creation, the creation itself was a perfect reflection of the Creator. Creation itself, this is a very important idea. Creation itself was a perfect reflection of the Creator, to the point that when you looked at the creation, all you saw was Creator. Let me give you an example. There are certain artists, if you know their work, you look at their work and what do you see? You see the artist. You hear a composition and you hear the composition, and if you know compositions, if you know classical music or whatever, you hear that song, you hear that composition, and you know who created it, because the music or the art is, we're going to use terminology here that evokes the idea, is transparent to its origin, to its creator. So you have the origin, the source. You have the derivative of the source. In other words, what the source creates. There is a stage, or there is a state, a potential state, where the creation is completely transparent to the source. That when you look at the creation, all you see is the source. You don't see the creation as a self-standing entity, something that evokes itself, that says, hey, look at me. When you look at that, you see the source. Beginning of creation, God created a universe that perfectly resembled Him, whatever that means exactly, perfectly reflected the divine light. Again, we're using metaphor, metaphoric terminology again, but again, we can only use the words that we can use. In the beginning, God created a universe, a creation that was transparent to His reality, that reflected perfectly His light. Not only did it perfectly reflect His light, God's light, it didn't at all have its own self. It didn't have its own ego. It didn't stand for something other than the Creator, other than the source with a capital S.
Like clone.
Think, it's not a clone. It's not another God. It's a creation, but it's a creation that doesn't say anything other than I am a creation of a source. Right? When you look at it, you say, hey, how you doing? What's your name? So it says, what's my name? This is who created me. You know, transparent to the source. Doesn't assert its own self. Doesn't assert its own ego, its own dynamic. Doesn't assert its own reality. All it does is evoke. All it does is call attention to its source. In fact, Kabbalah teaches that there are still spiritual realms that do this. In fact, there's a world called the world, without getting too Kabbalistic here, It's a longer discussion. There's a world of Atzilut, the world of emanation, that when you look at the world, all you see is godliness. You don't see a world. We call it a world or a realm. But when you look at the realm, you only see godliness. You don't see the realm itself. You don't see the space itself. It's almost like, you ever see those cool, I think it's in Fernbank, right down the road over here. Museum size. But it's really, you could see it anywhere. It's basically, you know, you have like a tank of water, and you put in, you know, these little balls that are like liquid filled or whatever, and you put them inside and they disappear. All you see is the water. You pull them out, you schlep it out, and you see there's an entity in there. But when it's in the water, you don't notice it because it's all what? It's all liquid. Anybody have any idea what I'm talking about? Sort of. You ever see those balls that they put, like, you have flowers? You know, sometimes they have those, like, those little round. See through, huh? Yeah, but no, but they're not marbles. They're not hard. They're soft. They actually begin as small pellets, and you put water. Anybody know what I'm talking about? They're like little. You put water in these little small balls. They expand, and they're soft. And we put flowers. They stay fresh. We've done it before, and the only reason I know this is because we've done this before for events and whatnot. Here's the point. It's really nice. It looks nice. But they're clear. You put them in water, then my kids love it. After the event, we take a Ziploc bag, you pour water in the Ziploc bag, and you hold the Ziploc bag, and it looks like it's only water in there. And you scoop out a handful of stuff, but when it's in the water, it's absolutely clear. What's the point? The point is you can have, it's transparent. You can have something that is, but when you look at it, you don't see it. There are realms, like angels. When you look at an angel, what do you see? A messenger of God. Not like we've seen angels. But theoretically, if you saw an angel, what is an angel if not for a malach? is a messenger, is an emissary of God. So when you look at the angel, you wouldn't see, oh, look at the angel. Where did you get those clothes from? You wouldn't see that. Oh, cool. When did you trim your wings? It's like you wouldn't look at that. What you would say is, wow, that is a messenger of God. It doesn't evoke its own identity. It evokes the source, the beginning of creation, the entire universe. All of creation was exactly like that. How do our sages tell this to us? Using the metaphor of sun and moon. And the relationship between sun and moon. The sun is the source, and the moon is the reflector. Listen again. The sun is the source of the light. The moon doesn't have its own light. The moon is a reflector of the light. In the beginning of creation, they were both large. What that means is God, of course, was shining. God's light was present. The moon, creation, which is only a reflector of light, was also fully bright. In other words, it fully reflected God's luminescence. Creation evoked a creator. When you looked at creation, you said, ah, there's a creator. Comes along the moon, comes along creation, and creation says, so what's the point? If when they look at me, all they see is you, so what do you need to create me for? They're still only seeing you, so what do you need creation? Before creation they saw you, after creation they only see you, so what's the point? They still only see you. Why'd you create? So God says it's a good point. Two kings should share the same crown. It doesn't make sense. In other words, that's the moon's complaint. The moon's complaint. Creation says, creation again, the moon, creation, that which perfectly reflected God's light. If I'm perfectly reflecting the light, if I'm totally transparent, so why am I here anyway? Why am I here in the first place? You're creating a robot to do everything, to perfectly reflect your light, so then what's the purpose? So God says, you're right, diminish your light. You know what diminish your light means? Diminish your light means assert your own self. And you'll cease to be perfectly reflected. What that means is now there's darkness introduced for the first time. What is the darkness that's introduced? Creation now assumes, creation now attains the status of self. It now identifies with self. When you look at creation, you don't see only the reflection of the divine. You now see, oh, there's a world, a human being. You don't look at a human being and say automatically, necessarily, there's a creator. You say, oh, there's a human being. What do you do? Where do you go to school? Suddenly, you have otherness. Otherness that emerges. And this is what it means that the light was diminished. It no longer is it perfectly reflecting the source. It now has its own light, but in the context of the divine light, there's an element of darkness there. Let's read this inside. What they did was, for better or for worse, they actually created a fake conversation, dialogue here on page 62. Howard, take it away. Page 62, we have God and Moon conversation 1.
Dear God, Susan. Why don't you just shine your light directly? I bring nothing to the table. Good point. You are brilliant. Sorry for the pun.
It's worse than me. Yeah, I can see.
Okay, then let's revise the original plan. Diminish your light. Stop.
Again, this is exactly what I said. This is the explanation that's brought in Kabbalah. That originally the moon is creation, is us, is whatever, is us. The moon says, I'm perfectly reflecting you, fine. So what do I need to be here? Again, before creation, it was your presence. After creation, it's also your presence. All they see is you. So what do I need to be here? So God says, you're right. Assert your own self. Diminish your light. Stop reflecting me. Be your own self, if you will. So now suddenly there's self, self-awareness, self-consciousness, self-absorption, self-centeredness, self-admiration, and selfishness, the ability for selfishness to exist. And now it's a game changer. Instead of seeing only God, now the moon sees self. It shines its own light. The next thing you know, guess what happens? The next thing you know, you have Adam and Eve. Cut to the next scene. Adam and Eve. And what are they munching on? Tree of knowledge. After God told them not to eat it. God says, don't eat of that tree. Next thing you know, they're eating. How's that possible? Guess what they're asserting? Self. They're asserting their own desire. Self-identity. Self-absorbed. This is what I want. That's what God wants. But I have my own light. That's God's light. In a reality, listen very carefully. In a reality, prior to the diminishing of the light of the moon, sin is not possible. If not for the fact that the moon's light is diminished, i.e. creation gets its own identity, assumes its own identity. If creation is only perfectly a perfect reflection of the divine, in that situation, there's no possibility for sin. A world that organically, innately, inherently, perfectly reflects its creator, intuitively, can't sin, can't do anything wrong. It naturally reflects. It's like a mirror. A mirror never says, oh, I'm not going to reflect. You shine the light, it reflects back. So the mirror says, so what do you need me for? If it's still the light, it's like you had the light before and I had the light again. So what do you need me for? So God says, you're right. Shine your own light, do your own thing. Or you have now the ability to do your own thing. So now this is where sin comes from. Text number 7. Joel, take it away.
The sin of the tree of knowledge is caused by the diminishment of the moon, that is, the lack of light. It is this lack that allows for the possibility of sin in this world. For if God's light were revealed, sin would be an impossibility.
If the moon of creation were to perfectly reflect God's light, sin would be an impossibility. All right, so we get the idea. What happens next is the moon realizes, uh-oh, messed up. The moon sees, again, this is all metaphorically, but the moon, creation, sees, well, this is not so healthy. We just did a big no-no. We just ate from the Adam and Eve just ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That was not part of the plan. And this is like a big, now we're out of the Garden of Eden, we've been kicked out. This is not, it sounded good in theory to have our own identity, but now it sounds like the plan is being derailed here. We're completely off track. So the moon comes back, and the moon says, this is not okay, this is not good, this is not ideal. 63, Melissa, take it away. God and moon conversation number 2.
God, once again, you're asking...
No. The conversation number 2, where it says, moon, please God. So here we have the big question. The big question is, it was a huge mistake. Let's go back to the old way. Yeah, before, maybe I didn't have like significance or whatever, but at least I wasn't creating darkness. At least I wasn't making a negative choice. And by the way, this question of the moon, and let's go back to the way it was. This question of the moon, understand, is not only the question of the moon in this metaphor, but it's a question that all of us ask. The moon sees the darkness, the pain of separation, all the struggles that will be born of this scenario where the world of mankind do not automatically reflect God's pure and bright light, and the moon says, this is not the way it should be. And we all ask this question, why is the world a dark place? Why is it that evil sometimes prevail over good? Why is it that horrific actions can happen? Why does God allow it? Why is it so hard for me to do the right thing sometimes? Wouldn't it be easier if God made me, made others, made everyone only with the sole focus and desire to do good in the world? The world would be such a better place. We ask this question. Why is there darkness in the world? Why is free choice given to human beings to God forbid, choose destructive? It would be so much better if there was only one possibility and that was good. It would be so much better if the moon was big. If the moon was perfectly reflecting God's light. The way it was. This is the moon's question after it realizes that with autonomy and with freedom of choice and with the ability to produce, to make your own choices and to grow dark, if you will, darkness is not so pleasant. And so the moon says, oh, I'd rather have the light than the darkness. And what does God say? We ain't going back.
It's not what I want.
We ain't going back. Deborah, take it away. God and Moon conversation 3.
God, once again, you are absolutely right.
between the Western and Jew. This is certainly not the way I want it to be. So you will fix everything? God. Sorry, I cannot do that. You can't fix the situation? Why can't you just put things back to the way they were? God. Because then we would be back to square one. Your complaint, as you recall, I told you, had merit. What purpose is there in having an other that really isn't an other? Moon. So what now? Are you saying that there is nothing to be done? God, I did not say that. There is a way to remedy the situation, but my hands are tied. I need you to take charge now. Only you can clean up this mess.
Understand what God is saying. It's a profound idea. What God is saying is, here's the deal. Yeah, we could theoretically go back to the old model where there's only one option, there's only light, there's only divine light, and there's no otherness, there's no darkness, there's no free choice, etc. But you know what? Then there's no relationship either. Then there's no value, there's no significance, there's nothing to the fact that you made a choice for good. The fact that you shine light means nothing if you have to shine light or if you automatically shine light. But if you can be dark and you choose to shine light, then you have now done something phenomenal. You've chosen to be in a relationship with me. And God says, that's what I want. I don't want the way things before creation. I had what I wanted, and it was all about me. But the whole point of creation is for there to be an other, and for the other to choose to engage in relationship with me. If I impose the relationship, there's no relationship. If I create another and program the other to be in love with me, so then there's no relationship. I can convince myself there's a relationship, but there's no actual relationship. The relationship is when the other has the choice, could choose not to be in the relationship, but chooses on their own volition to be in the relationship. Now it's a relationship. What it takes though here, what we see here, the upshot of all of this is the profound vulnerability that God imposes upon Himself. He didn't have to, but He chose to. God chose to, so to speak, tie His own hands behind His back and say, look, I'm not going to force you to reach out to me, to acknowledge me, to know that I exist, to do the right thing, to make healthy choices. I'm not going to force. I'm going to put both options there. The light and the darkness. You're going to choose. And when you choose, it's going to have significance. Because if you couldn't choose, then your choice means nothing. And now that you can choose the opposite, many will, and many have chosen darkness, etc. But when you choose good, it means something, and it means that you want to be in a relationship with me, and I want you to be in a relationship with me. Why? We don't know why, but that's what God wanted. We don't know why ultimately, but that's what God wanted. God wanted to be in a real relationship, and a real relationship, I said this is going to be real relationship advice, requires vulnerability, requires putting ourselves out there and not knowing how the other one's going to choose, not knowing how the script is going to play out, not knowing if it's going to work out or it's not going to work out. But that's a relationship. It means putting yourself out there to make yourself vulnerable to what may happen. This is the lesson that God teaches us. This is the lesson of life itself. Where God says, I have a plan for the world. I want the world to be a better place. But you're going to be my partners in creation. And a partner means that you're going to have a role. Because if I programmed you to fix the world, it was never broken in the first place. If part of the software, part of the program was a self-fixing thing, then it was never broken. It has to be legitimately broken, and you have to have a legitimate choice to further break it, to further destroy it, or to fix it. And when you choose to fix it, now you're a real partner. You're a real partner that has real significance, and therefore I give you the greatest gift, God says. I give you the gift of meaning. Because otherwise you would be a robot. You wouldn't have any meaning in your life. God says, I'm giving you the greatest gift and making myself vulnerable to be in a real relationship. What do you have?
Is that the same idea as Simpson?
100% same exact concept. That tzimtzum is a Kabbalistic idea that God withdraws His presence in order so that we can exist. And again, it's the same concept. That tzimtzum, this contraction of light, this withdrawal of divine presence, is the same as the miut halavana, is the diminishing of the moon. The diminishing of the moon doesn't physically mean the moon gets smaller. It means that the light ceases to shine automatically. Which is why, by the way, guess what the moon does every month? It waxes and wanes. It's bigger and smaller. There's ups and downs. Think about life. Think about ourselves. Sometimes we reflect God's light more. We're doing more. We're living more aligned with our purpose. We're more transparent to goodness, etc. And sometimes we go the other way. It's a little bit dark. So God says, this is what I want. I don't want to go back to the old model because then you have no role. There's no purpose of the world. There's no reason. God says, I'm creating a world. I'm creating a platform for me to be vulnerable and for you to have significance. And this is life. And now that you know this, when you have free choice, know that the only reason why you were given free choice is to make the right choice. The only reason why I gave you choice in the first place is to make the right choice. You could still choose the wrong choice, but know that they're not really equal choices, even though they are on one level. But really, the only reason why I gave you the opposite choice is that the right choice should have significance. But of course, I want you to choose the light, right, bright choice. That's what I want. Now, a few more points. This explains, we're not going to do these texts inside. We simply have no time. We're like, it's 9:31 or 9:32. Very, very quickly, this is what it means in the story of the moon when the Talmud says, in Tractate Chulin, when the Talmud says, God says, I need atonement now, offer a sacrifice in Rosh Chodesh, the goat of atonement. Say the commentaries that atonement doesn't mean forgiveness, atonement means removing something. Atonement means like wiping the slate clean, atonement means removing something. God says, remove this complaint of the moon against me, remove it. How? By offering the sacrifice. The Hebrew word for sacrifice is karban. Karban is related to the word karov, lekarev, to draw closer toward. God says, you know how to reverse the claim of the moon? The moon says, you gave us free choice, you gave us too much. That's what the moon is saying. You gave us too much power. And look what's happening in the world. People choose darkness. Why do you give us so much power? You have too much faith in us. And God says, of course I have faith in you. And now I want you to bring a carbon. I want you to come closer to me. I want you to make the choice. I want you to offer yourself. I want you to draw closer to me. And that will wipe away any claim of the moon. In other words, when we make the right choices, little by little, when we become more transparent to the source, then we remove any complaints of the moon. Metaphorical complaints of the moon. We remove any complaints because we're actually living brightly. Does it make sense? And that's why the sacrifice was brought in Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is the beginning of the month when the moon is at its smallest. There's almost no moon. Moon is just first appearing once again after it went almost completely disappeared from our sight. What it means is that in these moments of darkness, a person, it really hits home, the fact that there's a possibility, and we know recent events, the possibility for there to be so much darkness and death and mayhem and terror in the world. The way we look at it as, look at the vulnerability, the extent that God makes Himself vulnerable. God says, I'm not going to clean up the mess. You're going to clean up the mess. I want you to clean up the mess. Human beings teach each other to clean up the mess. I gave you Torah. I gave you values. I gave you life. I gave you right and wrong. I gave you life as opposed to death. The goodness of life as opposed to death. And now live it. And it's Rosh Chodesh when things are dark that we're reminded of this power, of this vulnerability, and the power that we have, and the significance that we have in making the right choices. And finally, we go back to the story beforehand where God says that He prays. What's God's? God prays, may my mercy overwhelm my anger or whatever. What does that mean? Who's God praying to? God prays to us. God prays to us. What's His prayer? Please, I beg of you to make the right choices. I'm asking you to please choose a relationship with me. I really, 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 really want to be in a relationship with you. But if I impose it, it's not a real relationship. So I'm giving you the free choice, but I'm asking you, please, do the right thing so that there can be goodness in the world. So that there is no death and destruction in the world. So that the world is a bright place as opposed to a dark place. But the control, the power is in your hands. And that's why He asked Rabbi Shmuel the Kohen Gadol. He says, bless me. You give me a blessing. Elevate me. In other words, God is saying, I'm making myself well. We said, how could it be? If God is perfect, God is everything, how can anthropomorphically, how can we understand this metaphorically that God needs something, so prayer is about it. He needs something that He doesn't have. How can God lack? You know how God can lack? When He makes Himself vulnerable. This is one of the most daring teachings of the Kabbalists. Think about it. That God made Himself vulnerable. This is the Tzimtzum. Kabbalah says Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum HaRishon, the first withdrawal of light. The concept of Tzimtzum sounds conceptual. God was everywhere, so He made Himself smaller to allow us to exist. Vulnerability, it's all in human terms, it's all about vulnerability. That's what God's doing. Make Himself vulnerable to a relationship that He can't control, in a sense. Only we can control our end of the relationship. And God therefore asks us and prays to us and says, you choose to be in a relationship with me. choose to do a mitzvah, choose to study Torah. And this is also the deeper meaning of the dialogue between the heretic and Rebbe Vo. I know I'm running through things, but hopefully it makes sense. The dialogue between Rebbe Vo and the heretic. The heretic says God's a Kohen, a priest, and he became impure. And we said, yeah, Rebbe Vo was humoring him and sending him off his way. You know what? He's right. God does become impure. God does make himself vulnerable. When we're impure, when we're in a bad spot, God, in that relationship with us, as one with us, also, on some level, is in that spot. Not objectively, but as he projects himself within this relationship and makes himself vulnerable, then God also has a state of impurity. If we're impure, he's impure. Because if we're in a real relationship, and there's darkness in the world, so it's his world. So the relationship works both ways. So how do you become pure? Not through water. Water signifies, according to the mystics, coldness, settling down. That's not what gets us in the relationship. It's fire. It's passion. God says, Rebbe Vo says, that what purifies? What does God want? How does God get pure when we get pure? How do we get pure? Pure, so to speak. How do we get back to a good spot? Not with water. Water always flows to the lowest place. Water always finds the lowest source. If there's a crack in the floor, it goes down. Water always seeks the lowest spot. Fire goes higher. Fire is heat. It's passion. It's fire. God says, I want our relationship not to be one of coldness and blah and all right, if you insist. It's not a real relationship. God says, I make myself vulnerable. I want a relationship. I want a passionate relationship with you. I want you to be excited about studying Torah, about praying, about doing a mitzvah, about making the world a better place. And then, please God, we will have the time when we'll truly have a better world, when we'll be elevated, when we'll reflect more light. And there's a beautiful... Lord, I want you to... who are at the Mark? Mark. Retext 14. This comes from the Siddur. Once a month, between the 7th and the 15th of the month, we recite a prayer called Kiddush Levana, which is the blessing of the moon. We don't bless the moon. We bless God who created the moon and gave us light at night. Amongst the prayers, this is part of the concluding prayers. Read this powerful stuff. Text 14, page 72.
May it be your will, my God, and the God of my fathers, to build a deep bed for the moon, so that there is no diminution in it. The light of the moon be as the light of the sun, as the light of the 7 days of creation, as it was before it was diminished, as it is said, that God made the two great moons.
And that's our prayer. Our prayer is that we ask God to help us, help ourselves, bring about a time when indeed the moon, creation, the world, life, human beings are only reflecting light and never, God forbid, darkness. And when the moon will be as light as the sun, but this time it's very different than it was before. Because at the beginning it was as bright as the sun because that's how God programmed it. And now, in the future time when it's as bright as the sun, when creation, when people are as bright as the sun, reflect God's truth, it will be because of their own choice. And that makes all the difference in the world. And that's significant. May that time come soon in our days. And let us say, Amen. Thank you for joining me tonight. Hope this made sense. If you have any questions, we have time now after the class to schmooze. Next week, let me just give you a teaser of next week. The topic is an idolatrous king, the Jewish perspective on challenges and failure. The Talmud's, and this is what we're going to be covering, the Talmud's amazing story of an evil monarch who came back from the dead to teach us one of the most important life lessons we can ever hear. That's all next week. You don't want to miss it. And invite your friends as well. All right. One other thing that I want